survey of the campus, and you recall that there were 389 who favored a policy, 389 who opposed a policy. I think the board's decision is going to be dispositive on that. And again, the board will meet again in Fairbanks November 5th and 6th. That is their budget meeting. It's been extended from a one-day to a two-day meeting because of their concerns over the budget. They also will be taking up, I believe, on the second day, issues relating to teacher education. And there's been some discussion of a merger of the three schools of education. We're not sure exactly what that means. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions that I can answer.
Jane?
Yes, that's at UAF. The difference, $1.5 million with benefits is, depending on level of position, right in that range.
And is there any, we know what sort of positions, or that hasn't been?
That's part of the board's frustration, and our challenge is we really don't know how far we're going to cut until the legislature adopts our budget. So if the legislature adopted a flat budget, essentially exactly the same dollars we have this year, we're estimating about $14 million in pay raises and fixed costs that we would have to absorb. Absorb is an easy word for say, easy way to say cut. If there were a tuition increase of our share was about $1.5 million, we would have to cut 12.5 versus 14. However, we don't know if the legislature will add money or subtract money, and so it's the last $1.5 million within whatever the legislature gives us. And so exactly which positions that is, we really don't know until we know the overall level. The board's frustration is we can't exactly say what that $1.5 million buys, other than less reductions than if we don't have a tuition increase. So that's the challenge we have. We're really trying to figure out a way that we can make it clearer what the impact is. So as clear as we are so far is about that many positions.
Other questions? Can somebody pass the mic, please?
You understand the political side of all the different border regions, and from my understanding, a few of them will be replaced at the end of the year. Could you help us understand how that might affect positively or negatively the board's position with respect to UA?
The terms of four members of the board go through February 1 of next year. Whoever is governor in December would make the appointments for those four positions. Two of the four current regents have indicated they will seek reappointment. Two will not seek reappointment. Of the tuition vote was 7 opposed and 4 in favor. 3 of the 4 in favor are among the 4 whose terms are up. So, and there is a 5th position, the student regent will be up at the end of this academic year. In order to make a change in the tuition policy, and I don't think the president has decided yet whether to go forward with the inflationary increase that would have been in board policy, the board members who voted no would have to vote yes.
Could somebody pass the mic there, please?
Combining of the schools of education, do you foresee a timeline of when that would happen and how that might affect bipartite, tripartite faculty, and would we still have school ed on this campus? And I understand also that the board is looking at other schools to combine as well.
The I've tried to lay out a sort of matrix of the issues that would have to be considered, you know, it ranging from the effect on already tenured faculty to the effect on pre-tenure faculty to the effect on how we relate to local school districts, to curriculum, to the answer is it depends on what model might be chosen for us. And there are about 14 or 15 other criteria that one might consider. There's been mention of combining of schools of business and management as another possible approach the board would take. We don't have a clear sense of exactly where to go. Susan has been meeting regularly with the deans of education, and maybe I know I'm stumbling here. I don't have the foggiest how this would work.
David Valentine, could somebody pass the mic, please?
Susan, maybe.
Well, I'll just add a little bit to Chancellor Rogers' answer. He's correct that no decisions have been made yet, and it's very difficult to speculate about what decision might be made in the absence of that. The approach that the three provosts, the three deans, and the vice president for academic affairs and research at Statewide, Anna Thomas, are taking is initially to go to the board at the November meeting with a very clear statement, as clear as we can make it, that the biggest issue facing the schools of education right now is the change in the CAPE accreditation standards. And we are going to urge the board to focus, let us focus on that, and not make any changes to the organization of the school until after that issue is resolved, which will take several years.
I just wanted to add that the Faculty Alliance has drafted a letter to both Governor Parnell and candidate for Governor Phil Walker, essentially urging a number of characteristics that we think are important in the next several appointees to the Board of Regents. Once we have gotten that done, we will, I talked with President Gamble on Friday, and he suggested that we also work with the administration on seeing if they'd be willing to endorse that, so that it's coming not only from the Faculty Alliance, but also leaders from universities. And just while I've got the microphone, one thing for you all to do, and for us all to do, is to be thinking in terms of who might be good regents. There's a number of professors emeriti that are in Alaska who we all know and many of us think very well of, who would be excellent additions to the board, who understand universities, who understand academia, and I think would help us a lot in terms of ensuring our needs, our capabilities, and so forth are well represented on the board.
Well, I'll try to keep my remarks brief. The Chancellor announced at the convocation that there will be a reconvening of the Planning and Budget Committee. The Planning and Budget Committee will have pretty much the same membership as last year, except for anyone who is not available to continue. The reason for that is that there's quite a steep learning curve in being familiar with UAS budget issue and issues and understanding what may need to be done in order to address the shortfalls that may occur after the legislature has acted. The Planning and Budget Committee is going to be working in pretty much the same way as it did last year, but we'll need to find additional savings so that we can be prepared if our budget is reduced or not increased, and so that we have to deal with a lot of fixed cost increases unfunded by the legislature. An additional activity that will be going on is special program review. As you know, we do program review of academic programs each year, but in addition this year there will be a focused program review that will look mostly at the smallest enrollment programs. There are several other criteria that were identified by the Planning and Budget Committee last year, including enrollment decreases over the past several years, low graduate to enrollment ratios, external funding in terms of research funding and other sources of funding and so on. This special program review will look broadly at programs. And the objective, unfortunately, is to identify the ones that we would need to eliminate if our funding is reduced as much as may happen with the legislative action. This isn't something that anyone enjoys doing, but if we are faced with having a much smaller budget than we have had in the past, we're going to need to deal with it in a way that's not going to seriously affect the ability of the university to continue to deliver quality programs and to be the leader in Arctic research as it is. So we will be seeking help in various ways for these activities. All of the committees, the special program review committees and the planning and budget committee do have faculty representation and faculty senate representation in particular. And there will be other opportunities for faculty to have input into the process.
Can I? Oh, sorry. Questions for the provost?
Can you be more specific by what you mean, what smallest means? Do you have like a number in mind? Or
There are some numbers. I haven't committed them to memory. I believe I may have supplied the flow chart to the Faculty Senate already, but there were basically a set of criteria that were agreed to by the Planning and Budget Committee last year. I will supply that to Jane, and she can make it available to all of the senators.
Could somebody? Oh, you have one.
This is really sorry. Question for Chancellor Rogers: do you have any ideas about alternative sources of revenue since the state seems to be getting less generous for it?
The primary sources of revenue for UAF are state funding, federal funding, and tuition and fees. The only one of those that we control is the last one, which is why we proposed an increase. We've tried to step up our philanthropic donations efforts over the last several years. That's paying off, and so last year where we set a goal of $8 million, we took in a total of a little over $13 million for the year. But much of that goes in endowments, for which we can spend 4% per year, so it doesn't make a huge difference. And really, it makes a difference at the very margin. That does not cover core operating funding. The other effort that has been made periodically over the years is to address the deficiency in the original land grant to the university and to try to create opportunities to earn funding from land. We've had legislation passed in various forms over the years, vetoed in various forms, or lost in court in various. There's some potential there, but I don't hold out really high hope for that making the kind of difference that state funding has. We've been doing, given the tightness of the federal budget, I think we've been doing remarkably well. And you know, our research faculty are among the most productive among their peers. So I don't see a whole lot of hope on the federal side to get additional indirect. So you know, bottom line is that outside of growing more millionaires in the state, I don't really have, I don't see significant opportunities for other external revenues.
I'll just add a couple of things. One is that our much of our enrollment growth in recent years has occurred in programs that are being delivered online. This is clearly a mode of delivery that students favor. Although some of the online courses enroll students who are also face-to-face and may in some sense draw enrollments from face-to-face courses, we are getting progressively more students that are attending wholly online and who may not even be resident in Alaska. And so I think that's one opportunity for growth. It's one that's highly competitive, and we will have to do more than an average job in terms of the quality of our courses and in opening up relatively unique programs in order to be successful in that area. One other thing that I will add is that although the federal environment is very competitive, we do have some wonderful successes there, and I would encourage everybody to strive to get what they can from that source. It's one of our best opportunities to get large amounts of money, difficult as it may be, and I understand that it's very difficult. I was in that world for quite a while. But the federal government, in terms of the amount of money that it has overall, is clearly the 800-pound gorilla in terms of a source.
Sorry, can I add one more thing to that? There's another potential funding source, particularly for research faculty. This year, about 50% of my salary is coming from private industry. And I think that's something that could be developed and better encouraged by the university. It's actually very difficult for me, I found, to get navigate the grant proposal process with a private company. That was a bit of an uphill battle. I think if that could be endorsed and improved by the university, that may help get private dollars.
Okay.
So, given this funding environment that we are in, so how can we justify adding essentially more administrators to positions that used to be filled by just one? So I'm thinking of the grad school dean right now.
The reason for that is because of particular Arctic initiatives that are going to be very active over the next couple of years. It is a temporary augmentation, I will say that, only for the period where we will need the extra effort from Dr. Eichelberger to lead some of these Arctic initiatives. And that's basically the justification. There are opportunities in the Arctic relationships that we're building for collaborative international resource research, potentially gaining some resources from other Arctic nations in order to fund some of these initiatives. So it's seen as an investment and one that can potentially pay off in additional revenue.
So just one more quick comment from me, and I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but these committees like the special review committees and those things, they're not fun, but I think this is kind of where shared governance, for shared governance the rubber hits the road. It's where we have to be part of decision making that is not pleasant, that is really hard. And I was on the BOG and the budget options group and the planning and budget committee last year. It was not fun, none of it. And it won't be fun this year. And again, the special review committees won't be fun. But that's our responsibility. It's much, much harder to sit on those committees and to be part of those decisions than to sit on the sidelines and be unhappy with them when they're made. So I really, really urge you to take that opportunity and to become involved in the positions where, with some likelihood, people will disagree with you or will be upset with your decisions. But that's where shared governance happens, and we need to kind of take that accountability with the input. I know that was preachy, and I know I'm preaching to the choir, but I just wanted to get that out. Okay, so with that, I would like to move on, though, to our guest speaker, Marcia Souza, who is the new director of the Honors Program and a former Senate president.
Thanks, buddy. I'm so delighted to be back at UAS. I've got a little handout. I'll just let Jane send them around both ways. And I did email it to Jane at the very last minute so that if you're online, she can send it to you. Probably when this is over and she has free time again. The Honors Program at UAS has been in existence since 1982, and it's pretty much still the same program that it was when it started. And it's not unlike most honors programs around the country. It's take a body of courses in the honors curriculum and then do a capstone thesis and present it. I think that that used to be a good model that was unique. It involved a lot of enrichment with small class sizes and a variety of honors classes, and then doing a capstone thesis where a project was a unique opportunity. It's not quite that way anymore, though, as many of you know, most majors are now deciding that doing a capstone project or taking some class or writing a thesis should be part and parcel of a baccalaureate degree. And certainly with all of our efforts here at UAF, research has become a primary focus of almost all students somewhere along the line. So with that, we're trying to try to look at some options. Right now, most of our honors classes are in the core curriculum. That's essential because that's where we would have enough students to actually have a real class size, since all students have to take the core. We have very few upper division electives, and even when we have a large group of students in one major, it's difficult to find all of them who want to take a course at a time in a semester and make it work for them. So we still don't have really the option to do a lot of upper division electives. We have 45 biology majors, for instance, in the honors program, but it still is not really possible to say all of them are going to take ecology in the spring of 15 or something like that. So we don't have too much in the upper division way. So a lot of our students create contracts. They work with you guys and other professors and add curriculum or alter curriculum that exists within a course to either increase the breadth, increase the rigor, provide some more experiential type learning, and we call that an honors contract, and they can get honors credit that way. So that's kind of where the coursework comes from. The capstone that they do write, they do need to do a capstone project or thesis, and they do that to meet honors standards, which are very broad, as you can well imagine, because we have all different majors, with permission of the honors program and of the major. They can use the same capstone in both their major and in the honors right now. I gave you a few little statistics on who's in the honors program. Right now, if I go in the banner and look, there's 273 students who say that they are in the honors program. They are cohorted in banner. It's not very easy to track them because of the way that we have to get at them in banner. Of those students, about half male and half female, and you can see that there's a variety, 52 freshmen, but 102 seniors, etc. Most of our students are in STEM fields, 45 in biology alone, but 95 in CNSM, 66 in engineering. BLA only has 24 students right now, and that's very different from what you see at most honors programs, where they tend to be really focused in the liberal arts. I don't know if it's an artifact of who the director's been over the last several years. They've all been scientists for the last 5 or 6 years. I don't know if it's more of a reflection of who we are as universities, that we've really focused in a lot of STEM fields, but that's who we have right now in the honors program. And there's a variety of students and others. And these numbers are not going to match up because I didn't include everything. I gave you a little bit of what honors classes are offered this fall as well. And you'll see some have enrollments of 1 or 2 or 3, and that's because it's embedded within a regular section. So they may be signed up for an FH1 section, but it's meeting with an FO1 section, and those students just have a little bit of extra work to do or a different assignment compared to their peers. You'll notice, too, though, that we have lots of students in Chem 105 Lab. That seems to be one of the most popular honors courses on the list. But getting back to the idea of what honors can really be, I'm looking at revising some curriculum and trying to create something that would be, would help the students really cohort together and work together and get to know each other and therefore be retained at a higher level. Because even though it says I have 273 students on the books, there's only 100 of them who are actually signed up for any kind of an honors class this semester. And that tells me that an awful lot of them are not going to graduate. In addition, it says I have 102 seniors, and last year there were probably 80 seniors, but only 10 of them actually finished out a thesis project and graduated with honors. So I have a feeling that while they're still in the core curriculum, they're taking lots of classes. Once they get up to the upper division, it just becomes too difficult, and they just kind of fade away without even letting us know that they're fading away. So my goal is to try to increase that retention rate. I'm hoping to do that by revising some curriculum in the first 2 years that help them bond together better and work together better and therefore be willing to stick it out and find creative ways to do that. I'd like to take our honors reading seminar, summer reading seminar, and expand it to be more of a first-year learning experience. include a lot of the things that are included in those other first-year learning experiences in terms of the soft skills and negotiating the university and student success kinds of things, and then require that the honors students take English 213 during their freshman year. Most of them place into it coming straight out of high school. Some do not, and they can take it during after 111, and take their communications 141 during their freshman year. That would make a nice solid block of courses that get them together, get them to go through the program together. And then in the sophomore year is when I'd really like to focus on something more different that we might do here. I would really like to see us do some interdisciplinary seminars that are truly interdisciplinary, take some kind of a problem and look at what the scientists do when they approach it. So I have somebody in natural sciences, social sciences, and humanities co-teach it, co-lead the discussion, so that you can get a variety of ways of approaching a problem. Have that culminate maybe with a seminar, invited speaker, somebody who's done significant work in the field, have the students lead the discussion. How to really be something that the students engage in deeply, but then it's brought to the broader community as well in some kind of public forum. So I'm toying with that idea. We have a new course called Methods of Inquiry that introduces students to all of the different ways of approaching a research project, both from the humanities perspective and the natural science perspective and the social science and engineering perspective. There's two courses on the books that to my knowledge have never been taught. There are honors humanities seminars at the sophomore level. I'd like to look at those and see if we can't revise those and maybe bring them back to the fore. With all of those sophomore level courses, though, the challenge will be that we have to have it count somehow in the general education curriculum so that it meets their degree needs. And that, of course, is a challenge. And, of course, as you know, since the core curriculum is under revision, but kind of, because we're being asked to combine it statewide and things like that, it's kind of on hold. So it's a little challenging to go forward with that. But I'm still working on it. I'm going to post some ideas to you guys in the next month or so. I'm also revising the way that we do our advisory committees. Many of you have served on those advisory committees over the years. I'm adding students to that advisory body in a way that they haven't been included before. That's the best practice nationally, so we're kind of looking at that as an option to increase communication and the cohesiveness of the program. We did write a new mission statement that I think better suits our needs and describes what we're doing and points us in the direction of working on student learning outcomes. So we decided that we would at least hold ourselves accountable for critical thinking, for ensuring that our students have a broad education, and for ensuring that our students all have some kind of independent scholarship by the time they graduate. And we're fleshing those out this fall as well. So our challenges are how do we create a program that really has value in a world where most of the things that used to be honors have now been taken over by all of the different majors, which is what honors programs are supposed to do. They're supposed to invent good things and they're taken over by the rest of the people. So we've done that. Now what do we do to really carve out a niche of meaningfulness for our students? How to retain and graduate more of those students? As you know that we're in a house down on Carper Lane, that's not going to last too much longer, so that's a challenge too, which we want our facility to look like in the future, and what the essential components of housing or whatever for an honors program. And then one of my big challenges is incentivizing faculty to teach within the honors program. How do I attract the high-quality faculty that will really provide a challenging curriculum for the students? How do I compensate them and their departments and their deans? And so to that end, I'll be meeting with lots of deans and department chairs over the next few months to try to figure out how we can do those things. So that's kind of the broad part. Any questions for me? I'm happy to answer them. I hope you didn't go too far over. So. On it, this all looks great, but I actually had a student who graduated in honors last year, and she was a student who didn't discover that she wanted to be an honors student until fairly late in her undergraduate career. So I would just urge you not to lose track of the fact that many of the students who are going to do well may not necessarily start off as freshmen thinking that they're going to be honors students. So I would encourage you to keep the door open for them to join later on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we, right now there's two different options. You can do the 27 credits and graduate with a thesis, or you can do 12 credits and graduate with a thesis. And we actually had quite a discussion about what does that 12 credit mechanism serve. It was designed primarily to bring in the transfer students, but as we're finding out, there's an awful lot of students who don't discover us or don't discover themselves until they're juniors. I've even had some join as seniors and still try to get that whole 12 credits out. As I said, I'm really digging into the data to try to figure out who our students are and figure out what the specific kinds of needs are to come from.
Chris?
Hey, Chris?
No, that won't work.
So, first
Chris,
of all,
that doesn't work.
Work.
You need the wireless one.
Ah, okay. Okay, just
so good. Can you all hear me now?
Yes.
Great, thank you.
So I have two things to say. First of all, thank you, Marcia, for initiating changes to the honors curriculum. Some of the things that I think look really interesting in this are the interdisciplinary aspects that you're incorporating. I do have a concern about what's listed under honors second year as a great book seminar. I'm not sure if this is conceived as an interdisciplinary course or as a humanities course, but I think that's going to be one area where if that were to move forward, you would have trouble attracting faculty to it. It's not a way of framing that type of material that is current, and I think you would have difficulty staffing that one. So I would encourage you to talk a little bit more to faculty and humanities and find out where the trends are in our field, if that was meant to be that type of a course.
Yeah, that's helpful for me. That's actually something that was proposed by a previous director, and it didn't go forward too far, but it looked really interesting to me on the book, so I'm happy before I go any farther to have a good discussion with you guys on that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
David, and then Anna.
Along the lines, I was going to mention this offline, but since the interdisciplinary thing came up, I'm wondering if we could look around at some of our interdisciplinary graduate programs, for example, RAP.
Yep.
And take advantage of them to, say, reach back into the undergraduate and nurture those students along.
And I have
two comments. One, I'm very excited about the possibility of the interdisciplinary seminar, and I think it would also foster...
Did you turn it off by accident?
No.
Sure you did.
You just killed it.
So I think that the interdisciplinary seminar could be very exciting from a number of different points of view, not the least of which is fostering communications between the departments who might otherwise not get many opportunities to do so. That's one comment. The other, though, thank you very much for working on this. It looks wonderful. One comment that I would make, not for the honors program, but more for the regular program, is that the student learning outcomes for this year, I would expect to be what we want out of all of our majors.
Okay. Other?
In some respects, we have to also be responsible for the same kinds of student learning outcomes since we have all of the majors. We talked about a variety of different learning outcomes. Did we want to require service learning? Did we want to require leadership? Did we want to require interdisciplinarity? And we kind of came back to these as what we could actually hold ourselves accountable for and map to our curriculum. So it is challenging. We've got these far more fleshed out than I gave you, but there's still a ways to go before we're comfortable with them.
I wonder if you could address the service learning aspect.
Well, when Gary Larson was director a few years ago, he instituted a requirement that they all do service hours. And then we looked a little bit at service learning. How would you incorporate it into the curriculum as an absolute requirement? How would you document it? How significant would it have to be, what really counts. We haven't gotten too far with it, but most of our faculty council is interested in kind of looking at that a little bit more deeply to see how we would actually implement it. There are some who feel like it would be fairly challenging in a community the size of Fairbanks to find significant numbers of meaningful service opportunities. I think there's probably plenty out there, but we just haven't gotten there. We may go there, or we may say we need to have some kind of an enrichment experience. It doesn't have to be service learning, but you might want to do that. You might want to do a leadership project. You might
want to do something else, but you need to have some enrichment in there somewhere besides just your curriculum. Challenging, interesting.
Okay, other questions or comments?
I have one comment, if I may.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, thank you, Marsha. I just wanted to add one comment that we have this undergraduate research opportunity for students, and that doesn't mean only science and engineering students. I mean, it can be a philosophy major or a psychology major. Anybody can do that. We might want to tap into that opportunity for independent scholarship that you're talking about. And I know Donnie just mentioned that she had an honors student graduate. I have one student who is actually brilliant and has gotten ARSA Global Research Fellowship. Mm-hmm. And something like that, you know, I mean, we can tap into some of those resources and see if we can graduate more. Thanks.
Okay, so now it is just about 2, and in 5 minutes we are taking our picture. So what I would like to do is give you all the opportunity to take a potty break. and then be ready for the picture. And then we are a little bit behind at this point. But so right after break, we're going to go to new business. Actually, we're going to have a discussion item first, which is really sort of I'll talk more about it when we come back. So please be ready ASAP.
I'm trying to see if I can hear you.
Really,
yes, I can hear you. Okay, thank you. Thank you. I wasn't sure if anybody out there spoke, if we could hear them.
Okay, people, if I could, if you could please get back to your seats. I'm going to try and move this along so we can fit everything in. Because nobody wants to stay after school. Okay, so I'm going to hand things over to Reiner now. His item is under discussion, but it's a bit more advanced than a mere discussion item. It is a draft motion that CAC has developed, and he wasn't quite ready to send it to you for a vote. He wanted one more chance at input. And so I'm going to hand it over to Reiner. Reiner, do you have a mic? Okay, all right, so here we go.
Your screen, your hand up straight, Caption 201, Slide 1. The purpose of this motion is to require that every baccalaureate program, this is not AA or AS, but every baccalaureate program, have as part of the major requirements of capstone experience. We try to craft this motion so that it is as inclusive of a variety of different sorts of experiences and not simply restricted to a class per se. We've also tried to craft it so that there is on record what that capstone is. It is not obvious on the program requirements. We know that there are some programs out there that do not currently have a capstone. What we don't know is this a hardship requiring a capstone? Is there any harm in requiring a capstone for all baccalaureate programs? And for better or worse, we also know that just given how busy everybody is, something really doesn't register with the typical faculty senator until it's actually brought up in a meeting. So this is our model for how we would like to proceed with curricular reform or curricular requirement reform, or baccalaureate requirement reform over the course of the year. It's brought up at one meeting. People get a chance to yell and scream at me. And potentially then take, having done so, and satisfy themselves, they then take it back to their constituency at the next meeting and will attempt to vote. Or if in fact there is at that point considerable dislike of the motion or whatever, then maybe we might set it by the committee or whatever, but want to make sure that something that is passed by the faculty senate is not simply something that only we know of, that we think is a good idea, it turns out there actually is substantial objection to that goes beyond this program. I will shut up and it's going to be an interesting discussion, seeing as I'm the one with the mic.
Well, so Reiner, what would you like for, what do you want from Senator? Because I'm going to try and watch the time here. So if the more specific you can be in your instructions, I think the better use we can make of the time.
That's an excellent point. Please point out situations where you think requiring cash debt experience would be evil, harmful, bad, wrong.
David?
Let's imagine that either program refuses to institute a capstone experience, doesn't get around to it, or students take the capstone experience, say, in the honors program, or would this be flexible enough to allow a student to take a capstone course or an experience that is not necessarily in that major? Could we have a gen ed, for example, capstone?
I think the way the motion is crafted, it certainly could allow for that. But that is the point. I wonder if it shouldn't be amended in some fashion to include the possibility. Well, and again, I mean, I think the whole idea of the capstone is that it is in nature. That's the whole point of it, is that it's a capstone in one's major. It's not a capstone in something totally different. I think as long as, for example, the honors capstone was effectively in the major, that's fine.
Okay. Other comments or questions?
So who would be deciding what would be considered a capstone? Because different disciplines have different kinds of culminating experiences.
The discipline itself would be decided. That's what it says here.
Wait, hold on, Reiner.
It will be the responsibility of each department, program, and or school, college to create, deliver, evaluate, and assess the capstone experience. We're not talking about setting up the capstone for weeks. Okay? We're not really talking about anything. I guess what we're saying is that everybody must have a capstone. It's up to you to decide.
So, what I remember, this is the court you helped me last time on this discussion. On the issue, because it was their definition of what the capstone was going to be, and then for us all to vote on whether we should have this capstone or not with absolutely no guidance to the
different. Right, okay, so would you take a look at proposed criteria for capstone? How this motion differs from when it was presented last May, it has the thing that says proposed criteria for capstone experience, okay? It has proposed instructional objectives, it has course examples and non-course examples.
So we are outlining. That's a little different from how I.
No. So there's a motion, okay, and that motion is accompanied by additional information.
Does that make
sense? Okay. Other comments or questions?
Chris.
Thank
you. So I just have one wordsmithing suggestion. I like the idea of the capstone requirement in general. I'm looking at the proposed criteria, and under the first one it says, require that students demonstrate the appropriate skill level in communication and as appropriate quantification. I do like what's in the parentheses there, but I wonder, given the diversity of disciplines within UAS, if we could have some language that says quantitative or qualitative analysis.
Okay. I would suggest if you have specific wording suggestions to maybe email that to Reiner. But are there concerns about the sort of the idea of a capstone at this point, especially sort of in the rather open format that it is presented at the moment? Yeah.
I guess that would depend a little bit on what Marcia can come up with for her honors program, because otherwise everybody is an honors student now?
No.
So the honors program essentially has capstone requirements, yes?
It's effectively a thesis. Okay, or equivalent. I'm trying to network to be exact, to be honest with you, as to what exactly the other program says, but the wording right now says basically a thesis or equivalent. Okay, we're not necessarily.
Reiner, you need to speak into the mic so the people on the phone can hear.
Got it. Let's just say that the honors program capstone requirement is much more specific about what it's going to be, whereas, for example, one possibility of a capstone. It's a portfolio, and doesn't really involve any or minimal amount of new writing, for example, or an exhibition. Again, the idea is that every department knows best what it ought to be doing as a capstone. Honors, in contrast, have a much more, at the moment anyway, rigid idea of what constitutes a capstone. That might change in the future.
Or should we ask the departments then to come up with a little bit nebulous definition of what a capstone would look like so that we can evaluate the program? I mean, at this point in time, there's absolutely no clue what education might consider a capstone. I think that's
Laura, right now, the motion is really just to say that every program should have a capstone. What that is up to the program. So each program will define its own capstone, and they can certainly use it for outcomes assessment. But it's independent of the thesis required for the honors program or any of the other things. It's really just a capstone for each academic program.
But it affects the core.
No,
it doesn't. It has nothing to do with the core. Absolutely nothing to do with the core.
Okay. Have you read this entire page? Okay. How about coming back to us when you have it?
May I just add something? Okay, so my view of this whole draft motion is this. What we are trying to achieve here is that at the end, when the students are going to graduate, they demonstrate that they have learned something in the last 4 years. So this is an integrative experience that they come up with. And I think that's good, because let us say if I'm just taking an example of a portfolio, for example, in music, they might come up with a portfolio only as a capstone experience that then can be sold when they're going for a job, and will be more, our students will be more efficient in getting a job, okay, because they have integrated everything. That's what the rationale behind this one is.
Yes, I understand all of that, but the key is that we're still requiring a degree to have certain new requirements added to it, correct?
Not necessarily.
Yeah. Our estimate is that something in the neighborhood of 2/3 of the existing degrees already have capstones embedded in them. And this might be as simple as identifying this particular course, which is one of the requirements, is our capstone.
So I would really say, why don't you study the motion? Because I think there's sort of a lot of confusion that could be clarified by reading it carefully, and then addressing concerns like that to Reiner. If for example, there's a concern about added requirements for programs or things like that. Does that sound okay?
I think this is one of these moving right along statements.
Okay.
You're trying to push things along, right?
I'm trying to push things along, but I also don't want to sort of have a discussion about things that maybe we're not as informed about as we need to be.
Is there an opportunity after the Senate meeting for folks to interact on this online?
Google Groups, yeah.
I don't know if there's one set up yet.
It's set up.
It's set up, so...
We need to post to it.
Yeah, so it's set up. People can contribute to the Google group. Okay. All right, so I'm going to move on here. I'd like to have the governance reports. Chris, are you here? Is anybody here from ASUAF? Okay, I know Danny is traveling. Tim, United Academics. Chris has the microphone.
Got a squeaky mic. Just briefly.
Can you turn off that other mic there? That's what is interfering. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's okay. It's done. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Just briefly, United Academics would like to remind faculty that union stands ready to assist members with the review, whether fourth-year tenure and or promotion or post-tenure review. Feel free to contact me or any UNET representative, I believe, member for guidance.
Great. Comments or questions for Tim? Okay. Jane, do you have anything from UAFT?
Yes, from
Oh, yeah, great.
UAFT is still in negotiations, so that calls for that. The Joint Healthcare Committee, the next phase of the loan program is going to run November 1st through April 30th, and we should all begin any communications about that.
Great, thank you. Questions, comments? Okay, then I'm going to move on to new business. And there are two motions by unit criteria.
So the first motion that the Unit Criteria Committee has is to reaffirm the unit criteria for the Marine Advisory Program. There aren't any enormous changes to these criteria compared to previous years. There were a few formatting discrepancies between these and the standard template that were resolved during the review process, but there weren't any major changes. So we move to approve them.
And you're urging us to rubber stamp here.
Well, the criteria are in your packet. Is there any discussion?
Okay, so we have a motion on the floor. Anybody want a second?
Second.
Any objections? Okay, passed. And that was for both of them, I assume. No? I'm really trying to. No, okay, so.
So we should do math and statistics.
Let's do math and statistics, yes. Okay.
We also move to reaffirm the unit criteria for math and statistics. There were with these some discrepancies between the standard template and what the unit had that were resolved during the review process, but there weren't any substantive changes to the either. So the committee is recommending that we approve them. And those two are in your packet. Is there any discussion?
Okay, can I have a motion?
Seconded.
Okay, seconded. All righty. Any objections?
No.
Moving right along. Okay, then we have a resolution. Who wants to speak to this resolution? Okay.
So in August 20th, staff council meeting, staff council approved the resolution supporting the UAS FY16 capital budget request, expanding the early childhood program in Alco. And Committee on the Status of Women brought it to the Senate, and we'd like to approve it, to endorse it.
Anna?
Can I ask a question?
There's a mic right there.
I would be more than happy to approve it. I just have a couple of questions because it's not clear to me when you say the early education program, parentheses, the Mel House, are these for improvements for the building or for the program? And if so, if the latter, what kind of improvements are we looking at?
I believe it's improvements, but I would give it to Chancellor.
So the capital budget included that amount for essentially a replacement facility for a larger facility that would license about twice as many childcare spaces.
But there is still no expansion of, for example, the ages at which you're looking at. It's basically going to remain 3 to 5, just more spaces for kids.
Not necessarily. And we're really working through what the business plan would be. The goal would be actually to expand the ages as well. But that gets into a cost and licensing issue in terms of staffing. So we're trying to develop a plan, but clearly the need is there for additional licensed spaces for younger children as well.
Yeah, that's what I'm pushing for. I think we should be having expense to some 0 to 5 or whatever, you know, something along those lines. Okay, thank you.
Okay, other questions or comments?
What's the effect of passing this resolution?
What's the effect? It's like any resolution. It says that the Senate endorses this idea, and then Chancellor Rogers can take that.
The President has yet to make his final recommendation to the Board of Regents. That will go to the November meeting. They will act at the November meeting. So I think the staff council and the committee's hope is that by seeing the endorsement of it by staff council and the faculty senate, that would help get a positive action by the President and Board.
Okay, others? Okay, yeah?
So is this something that will affect the overall UAF budget, or is this a separate line item?
The UAF budget is really in two parts, an operating budget and a capital budget. The capital is for any building improvements, and so this would be, and each building improvement or new facility is a separate line item by itself in the capital budget. This would have an impact on operations in terms of the early childhood education lab school, in terms of some additional staffing would be required, and some additional fees would be received for the children attending the child care program.
Does the child care program currently support itself in terms of the income or the staff that it hires?
I actually don't know off the top of my head.
If this resolution hasn't been moved, I move it.
Okay.
If it's been moved, I'd like to call the question.
Okay.
Second.
Okay, thank you. Any objections to the resolution? Okay, none. The resolution passes. Okay, so before we move on to public comments, I would now like to insert our added agenda item. And Jane has the clip lined up. While she's doing that, I would like to have David Valentine introduce what you're going to see, and then after we see it, he'll provide a bit more context for what happened after this clip.
At the beginning of the Board of Regents meeting, typically there's a report from each of the governance groups. So that would be the Student Alliance group, then Staff Alliance, and then finally Faculty Alliance. So at the last Board of Regents meeting in Juneau, that was the order in which they were presented. So what you're going to see here is the third of those reports that was by me. And just by way of context, this report followed immediately after Monique Music presented a very powerful and fairly strongly worded statement to the Board of Regents on behalf of the Staff Alliance that raised, among other things, the low morale of the staff, particularly in the wake of the what has come to be called bonus gate. So that kind of set the stage a little bit for what you'll see here on the video clip.
Thank you very much. And Dr. Valentine.
I'm changing around the order in which I was going to give my presentation in order to more effectively, I hope, follow Monique's presentation. There's a consistent theme that we're hearing, which is how do we serve students better? And
And hearing that coming from the staff echoes the same thing that I'm hearing from faculty. We're all interested in doing that, and the board has made it very clear its interest in ensuring that we're doing a better job of addressing student problems and so forth. One of the problems that we as faculty have is that quite often we don't know what those problems are. We are happy to work with the board, with statewide administration, with our individual campus administrations to address the student problems as we understand them. What we, I think, lack to a large degree is a way that we can hear and understand the problems that the students are facing and how do we go about, so that we can go about trying to come up with ways to address them. But I want to assure you that in our conversations, we absolutely share the concern that you have expressed many times on the board, and that Monique has eloquently expressed here a shared commitment to understanding the student problems that they're facing and addressing those as well as we can. I want to address in my remarks just a couple of updates from the written report that we submitted back in August. And the two major items that we are attempting to address with the Faculty Alliance and the three faculty senates is our number one, the resolution passed in April concerning alignment of general education requirements, and two, alignment of the calendars among the three universities. During the August retreat of the Faculty Alliance, we had a very long, but I think very constructive conversation with the summit team. This is the first time that such a meeting has taken place, and I thought that was a really good step forward with respect to developing a working understanding between the summit team and the Faculty Alliance, and giving both of those groups a chance to understand what issues each is wrestling with. At the end of the retreat, we and then at the last week's Faculty Alliance meeting between the two, we've passed several resolutions dealing with both of the both calendar issue and the GDR alignment issue, and I just wanted to kind of give you a quick update on those. One is we proposed a working group to put together a calendar, or at least put together, scope out the issues associated with the calendar. That would be things having to do with the various components of aligning calendars, semester starts and ends, breaks and so forth, along with, you know, class times and so forth. So we proposed this to President Gamble and Vice President Dana Thomas, and we hope to get that working group up and going in the near future with a target date of February 15th to report back on their work. We've also asked a working group, or we passed a resolution calling for a working group to work on the English alignment, and that language has just finished up as of maybe 2 days ago, and that will be going forward to the affected people. I can share a copy of that with you. And similarly with math, we've passed a resolution asking a group of five representatives from the five major groups, that is the three math departments and the two developmental ed math groups, to get together and work on alignments of math as part of the academy. The last comment I wanted to make is that we as faculty are looking for opportunities to have more communication with the Board of Regents individually as well as groups. Many of you live in near or not too far, at least from campuses. We are looking for opportunities potentially to invite you to, say, faculty senate meetings or other meetings that where faculty will be there, so that there can be a bit more in the way of communication between faculty and board members. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Comments?
One comment I would have is that when you were explaining about this group to get together and talk about the issues related to the calendar, I think that's a great idea. But you said to outline the issues, not necessarily a calendar. And from my perspective, we need a calendar. I know there are going to be issues, and we need to do everything we can to communicate them, but there needs to be a calendar for all three universities.
So the final thing that we've asked from the working group, the third item on my list. The task force will report back the results by February 1st, 2015 to the Faculty Alliance, including both a summary and set of recommendations concerning options for partial or full implementation of the various elements of calendar alignment. So I realize that's not exactly what you just asked for, but the target, the ultimate target would be alignment.
But see, that's my concern, because all too often what happens is we talk about these things and we listen to what the goal is and we explain all the reasons that it's going to be difficult to get there, and we mitigate some, but we never get there. And so the point is that the goal ought to be to get there and to do what we can to mitigate the problems that it creates along the way. But the problems that are created by having different ones are much worse than the problems that can't be mitigated by bringing them all together.
So the conversation we had with the summit team consisted of comparing exactly those two sides of the issue. That is, what are the problems associated with the current calendar misalignment, and what are the problems that would occur as a result of aligning those. And during that conversation, essentially, the view was, let's look at what the problems are that we can address relatively easily with aligning at least parts of the calendar. They're a low-hanging fruit. Let's work on those first. Let's address those problems. There are problems that are potentially associated with full alignment of everything that would come up that would not necessarily solve that many problems, but would create several. So that was the essentially the, and I think perhaps that needs to be fleshed out.
The queue includes Regents Anderson, Wickersham, and Brady.
Thanks for your testimony and welcome to the group. I know that you're representing the statewide view, but I'm concerned about a resolution that was written by the Anchorage Senate that asks us to reconsider the GERs policies that we've made for that and the schedule. It appears to me that the faculty at UAA is bugging up and telling us that they run the show. That's not the case. And I think this appearance of arrogance and the reticence to get behind the plan needs to be squared away.
Regents Wickersham, followed by Brady.
I guess I want to follow on to something that are the general remarks that Regent Fuller Cowell made. Actually, the decision has been made to do a common calendar for all three schools. I've never been a faculty member. I'm not an expert on the conceptual notions of shared governance that probably go back to the University of Bologna and falls under the AD or something like that. But if we're going to partner with the faculty and do shared governance, that means, as Richard Collins said, that means that once the decision's made, move forward and implement it. And it's almost like, we're going to expect the presidents and the three chancellors to have a common schedule. We want the faculty to participate in that. We don't want to re-argue. We've concluded that it's in the students' best interest to do that. And I also associate myself with the comments that Richie Anderson it is now time to act. I've been on this board for 7 3/4 years, and the frustration sometimes in setting policy, looking for change, needing change, and then just not seeing it can be difficult for a volunteer. That's what we all are in this state. So I would encourage the faculty to get behind this 100%, to work out whatever issues you see, and to achieve that. So, that's
Did you agree?
Well, this is going to be repetitive, but I think it's necessary. The decision's been made. We're not interested in roadblocks or any diseases. And, you know, I've been for 10 years. This has been a key topic of discussion during my entire tenure. It's time to get this done and move on. And I hope we're being clear enough. And this is what we want.
Other comments? Seeing none. Thank you all. Well, President Gamble.
In defense of the process, I mean, I of all people want to move on too. And certainly, in working on shaping Lyme's future, working in policy.
So President Gamble now talks for 9 minutes. Oops. President Gamble now talks for 9 minutes, but I want to have David sort of summarize what the message was.
Those of you who know President Gamble know that he isn't necessarily succinct verbally. The major thing that he said that I really appreciated was at the end of his remarks, he said, what you have to hear from the governance reports is that there is commitment to move the needle in the right direction. That was the sum and substance really of his remarks. So he backed it, to my way of saying it, he backed the faculty to the Board of Regents, so I think he deserves some credit for that. So.
And he also said that having been part of the multi-hour discussion at the Faculty Alliance retreat educated him about the complexities of the tasks, and I, you know, from a faculty perspective, that was useful to hear. So he mentioned that in his remarks. Now, the reason I wanted to show this clip was not to get you all riled up, although you may be, but the reason I wanted to show this clip is to demonstrate the mood at the Board of Regents at the moment. And I mean, this is the reality. We may have different ideas about shared governance, but the truth is that they do have the authority. I mean, this is what Chancellor Rogers mentioned at the beginning of this meeting, is they do have the authority. So we need to find ways to work with the region within this current climate. And the Faculty Alliance certainly is attempting to do that. We can always use help on you know, various committees and tasks. David, do you want to say a little bit more of what would be useful for the Alliance?
Well, let me start by saying something that you also couldn't see on the clip, which was that Regent Anderson and I spoke later on, and he reiterated his concern about the UAA resolution and reiterated that the faculty, what he sees as faculty arrogance, getting in the way of the Regents running the show. My comment to him was, if it comes to some kind of headbutting contest between the faculty, which runs the curriculum, which is in charge of the curriculum at the three universities, and the Board of Regents, the university loses. And so we need to ensure that such a thing doesn't happen. And there we had good agreement. So I think that needs to be out there from the faculty side. Okay, now, what was the question?
The question was, what would, for the Faculty Alliance, which is the main governing body or governance body interacting with the boards, for the faculty anyway, what would be helpful in terms of, you know, input, suggestions, collaboration with the Alliance? We've already mentioned some of the committees, but what would be helpful so we're not sort of undermining the work that you as the Alliance chair are doing? Because I think that would be the most damaging thing if now, you know, individually we go off and undermine what our faculty governance is doing.
So here's the fundamental rub, is that each of the three faculty senates is fully empowered to act however it sees fit. We might tend to view the Faculty Alliance wrongly as being the proper channel through which the Faculty Senate communicate. Faculty Senates can and do communicate independently. However, if you really want the Faculty Senate voice to be heard and have it be clear, having it go through the Alliance and have it be in concert with the other two faculty senates where those alignments exist is a much more powerful statement to the board than when we have individual faculty senates going rogue. The president in my meeting with him on Friday essentially asked, look, you know, things like this come up in the future. At least try to get the faculty senate to vet these resolutions through somebody else. There's no censoring, there's no clearinghouse, but get some input, get some idea of how this is going to play out in terms of board support and board votes, because ultimately that's the reality that we have to deal with. So my reaction to your comment, first, is kind of a negative one, that is, you know, please be careful. And then second, be aware of opportunities to show something to the board about faculty and programmatic success. I spoke with a couple of folks, Jane and Cindy, earlier last week, I think it was, about the developmental ed issues, showing that the three universities are really working those issues. And I'd like the board to know that, because later on in the meeting there was some discussion of potentially outsourcing our developmental ed program.
Okay, John.
Yeah, I'd like to point out that every faculty senate at the UA system has had its run-ins with board of regents. I think it lists off every time for each of the senates that they've in the last 15 years where they've had a little bit of an issue that seems to be an anchorage issue. But I would stress that the senate's role, at least in my mind, focuses on the curriculum, and this senate should focus on the curriculum and what's happening primarily at UAF. And I would disagree that I think that the senate should be firing off resolutions to the regions. I mean, that's what the alliance is for. And the alliance is the senate president-elect and the past president of each of the three senates. So that should be the method. And if we were vetted through there, and you didn't have one of them going rogue, would be the best. Because I agree with the statement, we're stronger together than we are apart. And as long as you try to keep the message positive, say, yes, but here are the challenges we're overcoming, always, you know, start with yes, and hold together. And the hardest part of the alliance is to get these three senators to pull in the same string. That's what needs to happen. Otherwise, this will just get worse.
I think what deeply concerns me is something I brought up last year in this type of discussion, which is I get the impression that the Board of Regents, I don't understand where their concern specifically for the students is coming from, where the universities, a university, consists of multiple constituencies and a much broader mission than just having clients who are students. And it is not in the university's best interest to only focus on one constituency, but rather on the mission as a whole. And that includes research, and it includes the well-being of the people who work for the university, and it includes students. I am not disparaging students, and I am not suggesting that students are not important, but I wonder where has our advocacy gone for the university as a whole, so that it has become such a big issue over the past few years that only one constituency is being considered. And I think I'm sure I'm not the only one here, but it's obviously very detrimental.
Dennis?
I was perhaps a little bit opaque in my opening remarks to the board, but a major part of the reason why I said that was because I wanted the board to know that I knew that they were trying to address student issues. But those student issues seemed always to be behind a curtain or largely anecdotal. And at your point that there are other constituencies as well, but I just wanted to address that one issue concerning the students. They're saying that we're not serving the students particularly well in some ways, but that is not being clearly communicated to us, only that there are transfer issues or anecdotes about somebody being frustrated
I don't know what those really are.
Is it correct then that they, so just listening to the meeting, it sounds like they've obviously had these concerns for a number of years, and they've been working on it for a number of years, but so is it correct they haven't actually presented data to back up their sort of idea that the students are underserved in some way? It sounds like, I mean, from that meeting, it sounds like, well, we think this is going on. You then turn around and say, we're going to review it and give you the spectrum of pros and cons. They don't care. Is that correct?
Well, I think certainly the data have changed over 10 years. I mean, the student body has changed over the last 10 years. And Provost and Chancellor, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think data has been presented to the board. So could maybe one of you address where the concern is coming from?
It
doesn't matter.
The point here is that the board says do this, and when faculty elects individual faculty says, well, we don't really want to. We don't want to talk about it some more. They're going to get pissed off. And it really doesn't matter whether they're in the right or not. In this case, they're not in the right. But they told us once, and they told us twice, and I think if they tell us a third time, they're going to be really, really pissed off.
Oh, they're not going to tell us a third time. They're going to task somebody else to do it. Okay.
That's the real message here.
Okay, I would like to get the provost's input.
Okay, well, just very quickly. Over the years, we have provided the Board of Regents with stack of data reports about that high on a lot of these issues, developmental education, transfer credit, the number of students taking courses across universities, which relates to the need to align the calendars. So the regions have seen copious amounts of data. But they have identified several issues that they believe are extremely important, and two of them are the alignment of the general education requirements and the common calendar. And as Reiner points out, the extent to which those are objectively supported by data probably could be argued about. But what is hard to argue with is the constitutional authority of the Board of Regents, which is kind of there.
Okay, Doni?
I'm not that familiar with other institutions, but it strikes me that our Board of Regents is very far down in the weeds, and they are wanting to control things that the universities do at a very high level of detail that would be very different from, like, the University of California system or something like that. And I'm wondering if anybody has any ideas about things that we could do to maybe get them to move their focus to the level of detail that most universities have their Board of Regents at.
There's a wide variety among systems around the country in terms of the level of detail that that the board is in. In several states now, we have legislatures mandating things like common GERs and so it's not just the board that's in the weeds. We've tried over the years to ensure that the board stays at the policy level, but there are always, and when you have board members with experience in a larger organization, they tend to understand more readily the challenges of a policy board getting down into the weeds. But it's not always the case that you have people with that kind of life experience. And so it's easier to get your hands around some of the little issues sometimes than it is to address from the hypothetical 30,000 feet. So the board agendas this last couple of years have been the longest in my tenure, ranging up to 1,000 pages of agenda. That's way more detail than we used to have when we had printed agendas.
Okay, so this could be a very interesting discussion, but we're over time right now, and I do want to get to public comments. So if you would like, we can set up a Google discussion forum so we can continue this online. Definitely, if you have concerns, contact me and or Dubu about it. But I wanted to give you an idea of the climate that we're operating in, so you have some appreciation of what the likely response might be to various decisions. All right, so I'm going to open it up for 5 minutes of public comments. Can we have a mic at one of the corners there? And I understand that some of you may need to leave, but it'd be great if you could stick around.
I know that you all leave. I'm Corey Burrell. I'm the executive officer for the university, and I wanted to share real quickly some information about Arctic Day, which is coming up in November, just so that you're aware of it. We've scheduled Arctic Day for Thursday, November 13th. So it's Thursday, November 13th. We are going to kick it off with an evening activity on Wednesday before. The purpose of this day is to make sure that folks around campus are aware of the various Arctic activities taking place on campus. We style ourselves as America's Arctic University. Not everyone here has a role in Arctic activities. There's lots going on at the university, lots and lots of things going on, and not everyone's engaged in Arctic research or teaching, and so we just want to make sure that folks are aware of what's going on. The goals of the day, therefore, are to inform faculty about activities, to let students know what opportunities there are for them to engage in activities, and to solicit suggestions for more things that university lots of areas can do in this area. The plans for the day then are to kick off the night before with a keynote speaker, Alice Rogoff, who is the publisher of the Anchorage Daily News, the Anchorage Dispatch, will come up and speak. She is very interested in Arctic issues, and we'll talk about why she engaged in Arctic issues. The next day then we will have in the Great Hall a poster session for faculty members to share information about projects that they are working on. We will also have a student resource fair so students can learn about field schools that they can participate in, exchange activities, and academic offerings that they could engage in, take classes in. We are also thinking of that day of having a town hall where folks such as the chancellor and the vice chancellor for research and other folks, vice chancellor for university students, they can talk about things that they are seeing. Some big activities are coming up that everyone on campus should probably be aware of. And that's it. So I just want to make sure everyone knew that was coming up. And if you have any thoughts or questions about the poster session or would like to be involved in that, feel free to reach out to me.
Thank you.
Anita, I would like to ask about faculty what the status of the department chair revision is, and I got an email right before the meeting that it's been, now you have surveyed department chairs about their opinion of the revisions, and I would like to ask you as faculty senators to also talk to your constituents and share with your constituents the revised policy so that ordinary rank and file faculty can get their input into.
Okay, thank you. David, did you want to say something?
This is just an announcement. Back in last month, the Faculty Alliance proposed a method or a means to search for the new VPAA, the new vice president right now for affairs and research. The president has taken that and is using it. Going forward, the committee has been constituted, and any day now, perhaps already, the announcement is public and advertised. So if you know anyone who is interested in potentially serving at that job, Regent Wickersham took me aside at one point during the Board of Regents meeting, suggesting that it's it's terrible that Dana Thomas is leaving the position, and but we should be thinking about reaching down several layers, perhaps, which I took to mean as a hint to extend down to the faculty level, perhaps, for the BPAA. So they're hoping that, that this happens internally, and so I urge you to consider it or get your colleagues to consider it, who would be good in that job. Sorry, too much caffeine.
Great, thank you. So are there any other general comments or announcements or committee chair comments? I'm sort of bunching that all, the whole rest, the rest of the chunk together. Okay, can I have a motion to adjourn then? Okay, I see that there are no objections. Thank you, everybody.
Voting with our feet.
My dog is